Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast, first MadTech Podcast for 2021. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Yes, and Happy New Year and a big welcome to my guests, Kieran O'Kane.
Hello, Kieran. Hello.
And Lindsay Rowntree.
Hi.
We've corralled Kieran to join us from the comforts of his island retreat in Tenerife.
Thank you, Rachel. Yes, I escaped to Tenerife. I'm in my COVID bunker. It's a small island off the Canaries.
Not that small, is it?
I built a shack. It's only accessible by boat. Everybody has to quarantine for 2 weeks. Yes, here in my banana paradise island in the Canaries.
Yeah. And for the benefit of listeners, we have to put up with Kieran on our daily team calls, effectively with his sunglasses hooked over his T-shirt and, you know, palm trees in the background. So for those of us that are based in London, that's a bit upsetting. First news story I wanted to discuss with the two of you this week was announced actually, I think, on Monday this week, so something quite positive to kick off the year with, is asset management fund Guinness Atkinson announcing the launch of an AdTech and MarTech ETF or exchange-traded fund on the New York Stock Exchange. So this is big news, really, for the investment community in AdTech and MarTech. And I'm just having to deal with a lot of hilarity going on in the background with my podcast colleagues because there's quite a bit of background noise there on your holiday island. Including you snort laughing. I'm not even going to ask what that background noise is. It sounds like somebody's blowing up a rubber dinghy, getting it ready to launch out onto the beach.
There's a small party going on in the background.
Back to the AdTech and MarTech Exchange Traded Fund launched on the New York Stock Exchange. What's interesting about this is, from my perspective, it's giving anyone that's interested in investing in innovation around AdTech and MarTech a few more routes to entry, I guess I would say. And it's offering exposure to a much wider range of potential, of AdTech and MarTech companies and therefore giving those companies the opportunity for a much wider pool of investment. It feels like it's big news for AdTech and MarTech and also big news for the investment community. If you can tear yourselves away from your joint hilarity there, Lindsay and Kieran, would anyone like to comment on this story?
It's great. The fact that it's actually
great. You think everything's great at the moment because you're on paradise.
Look, I didn't expect to be Bob the Builder to turn up and start fucking doing some soldering next to me. What can I say? It's brought to you by Guinness, which is fucking first and foremost the best thing about it.
Not actually Guinness, but yes.
It is. Guinness actually, it's once you actually buy shares in that ETF, you get 3 pints of Guinness. That's actually a fact. Okay. To be honest, it's well overdue. Like, ad tech stocks have been on a tear for the last 24 months. And what's interesting about that ETF is it's quite varied. Like, it's not your typical SSP, DSP,
it's a whole range, isn't it? A whole range of companies.
Well, there's lots of interesting companies in there. I mean, the most interesting companies.
For those of us that aren't quite so fancy minded when it comes to things like stocks and shares, what exactly, for our listeners that aren't aware, what exactly is an ETF, Kieran?
Basically, it's a basket of stocks, right, that you can invest in. So think about a sector. If you want to invest in a specific sector, like gold mining or whatever, instead of investing in one stock, you can invest in a basket of stocks.
And so, therefore, it makes it not only just more attractive to a potential investor that might want to diversify their investments across a number of companies, but it also provides a much easier mechanism for investors to invest in a wide range of companies. So instead of having to make those investments individually in a wide range of companies, they can just invest via the fund that disperses their interests across the stocks available within that fund.
So basically, it's exposure to a sector whereby you don't have to actively invest in those companies. And it means that you can just basically passively invest. So like here's 100,000 or whatever you might have for the pharmaceutical sector or ad tech sector or whatever. And effectively, the people who put these funds together pick stocks that will, you know, if one does bad, then the other will do okay. It's just the way these ETFs are structured is generally they can sort of like take the dips.
Spread risk.
Yeah, it diversifies your risk factor. But as you said, Rachel, the makeup of the fund's really interesting because they have quite a few interesting companies in there. There's quite a few Japanese stocks, which I found interesting because, you know, there was a big piece in Bloomberg before the new year that Japanese equities are kind of undervalued in many ways.
You're right, Kieran. There is actually a really wide range of interesting companies in there, right? So it's everything from Google and Facebook, Tencent, Adobe, Salesforce, SAP, Accenture, Atlassian, right at Baidu, right down to, you know, the likes of CyberAgent, which are a Japanese company, Hakuhodo, large Japanese company. Who else have we got in there? iKick Interactive, you know, quite a few smaller Asian companies that typical investors, particularly investors in the New York Stock Exchange, wouldn't necessarily get exposure to otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole point of this ETF is that it gives them exposure to stocks that normally, I mean, these stocks would be listed on NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, and anybody from around the world can just basically invest in it, right? You don't have to be an active investor to go, I need to invest in Trade Desk. To invest in those stocks would be a bit of a mission for an ordinary investor. But ETFs are just brilliant because they give you exposure to sectors like this. And it's probably, you know, it should have happened a long time ago. I know that James Pringle, who was actually on this podcast, was on about doing an ETF himself for ad tech, but he didn't get around to it because it was just a bit too difficult. But I think Guinness is a Guinness investment. I can't remember the full title of the company.
It's called Guinness Atkinson.
Yeah, I think they've got a track record of putting ETFs together. So, and you could see the skills in it. It could have easily just been a bunch of, you know, household names and just put them in an ETF. But actually, there seems to be a really meticulous sort of choosing here. Like they've really thought about it. They've really thought about what stocks might do well and sort of like...
It's also interesting how they've bundled them together, right? So you've got your classic ad tech players in there, a couple of them, apart from Google and Facebook, such as Magnite, Trade Desk. But then you've also got the likes of Yandex, the Russian browser. You've also got Atlassian, I mentioned before, you know, Australian sort of owned but now global marketing tech platform. Even the likes of Accenture, Zoom is in there as well. It's actually
range. It's kind of like an attention economy type thing, right? Where, you know, I'd argue Yandex is an ad tech company because they make most 99% of the money from
advertising. Ads. Yeah, 100%. New York Times is in there as well.
That's a weird one.
S4 Capital.
That's a good one because X4 Capital is doing very well. Growth stock. SAP is a good stock to have in there because it had such a shit show of a year last year. It dropped about 40%. So it would probably increase in value. Just from an investor's point of view, it's probably a solid ETF to get involved because it's such a, they've got some nice stocks in there.
Lindsay, what's your point of view on this?
I think it's interesting. It's not something I know a huge amount about. So anything I say will be based on distinct ignorance and lack of knowledge probably, but I find it interesting. I think what I don't understand, it's interesting from an ad tech perspective because it almost it's calling out ad tech as being more than just a niche industry. The fact that it's actually that there are enough companies in the ad tech space that could be bundled into an ETF in the first place. And enough, not just enough to bundle them all in, but enough to actually pick and choose from, is what I find interesting. It shows that there's more, and that, you know, there's more stories of ad tech IPO happening in 2021. Obviously, Podmatic happened recently. I think it just shows there's going to be more and more activity. And I wonder if, like, ETFs appearing in the ad tech industry will almost kind of be a bit of a beacon for ad tech companies to actually want to look down the IPO route as well, where they wouldn't have before, because there's just more opportunities for investors to access them. What I don't understand about ETFs is, and Kieran, Rachel, the research you've done, and Kieran, what you know already, can give Atkinson, can they add more companies to them? Do they take companies away from the ETF? How does that work? If a stock starts performing really badly, will give Atkinson chuck them out, or what happens there?
I think to review the basket of stocks every couple of months to add companies in or take companies out, depending on performance. I mean, like, they've obviously clearly made a really concerted effort to think about the value stocks, right? So Pomatic's not in there, which is a brand new equity, and everybody thought, why is Pomatic in there? But maybe Pomatic is not in there because they are a competitor to Magnite. Like, they're an SSP, and maybe they thought, we've already got an SSP, do we need another one? But it's very ad hoc. I think, like, from my understanding is that they will review the basket of stocks every 6 to 12 months and they take out people. I'd love to know how they weight the stocks, because it'd be interesting to see who gets the biggest percentage. I would imagine Facebook, Google, and the big sort of, like, you know, walled garden ad tech companies are probably the more predominant in that basket of stocks and Trade Desk because of its like, you know, lofty valuation. But they definitely, like, mitigated any downside risk, because they've got, like, the likes of the Japanese stocks in there, because they're, like, there's a big thing about Japanese equities, and they're massively undervalued, so they're probably going to be a big, you know, rise in value of that over the next 12 to 24 months, because Japanese money has to go somewhere. And SAP, as I said, just had a really terrible year, so they're thinking, you know, if the Trade Desk does have a bit of a dip, or, you know, one of the big guys, SAP will make up for this, you know. So these ETFs generally really well constructed. It's good for these stocks, though. Good for the ad tech companies in the ETF, because they're going to get more volume, right? They're going to get more exposure. More people are going to buy their stock. So
this is actually really good general exposure for innovative ad tech and martech companies. They're getting some kind of mainstream recognition of the type of technology that they're building beyond just the industry itself. And do you think that's going to have a bit of an upside for them in general?
Well, as Lindsay said, it will probably encourage more ad tech companies to go public, right? Because there's more exposure for the sector, and it's all positive news at the minute, not negative. Like, for the last couple of years before Trade Desk went on its mini little run, it kind of was a lot of negative stories.
What do you reckon, Lindsay? Heading to your nearest financial advisor to get
I shall call Mr. Bank immediately and move some money around.
Interesting.
Think it's on Free Trade, by the way. You know, Free Trade, which is that the easy to use app. I've seen it, so you can buy.
Interestingly, the ETF on the New York Stock Exchange has got the abbreviation MRAD, which they said they're going to refer to as Mr. Ad.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I like that.
That's good, because, like, I thought it was MRAD, and I thought that's so confusing with MRAID, which is the mobile protocol. So
yeah, Mr. Ad, like Mr. Chips. Like, remember Mr. Chips from what was he in again? Catchphrase.
I was thinking of Mr. Pink.
Who's that?
What's it called? Reservoir
Dogs. Reservoir Dogs.
So, second news story I wanted to chat through with the two of you guys is an article published earlier this week whilst background distractions carry on for Kieran. An article published earlier this week on The Information was detailing a point of view that advertising revenue or advertising spend, which departed from traditional TV or was declining in traditional TV last year, won't return in 2021. So obviously it charts the kind of rise and fall of advertising spend in the TV landscape in general, and this is a US-based sort of study or point of view. throughout the pandemic, which is that it reduced quite significantly in the early days, made a recovery, but actually that recovery more was about a shift from traditional TV channels to digital streamed content. Now, the premise is that level of spend isn't necessarily going to return to traditional TV in 2021 because there's been a significant significant shift. But that's a separate matter.
It's a train wreck.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a significant shift in viewing behaviour. So that obviously is further digitisation of consumption of content, which has just happened right across the board, throughout global markets, across various age ranges. There's also increasing acceleration in cord cutting. There's been, and still continues to be, a dearth of live sporting events that would typically attract audiences to traditional TV channels, particularly in the US. In the UK, it's perhaps a little more dispersed. And it's that advertisers have now gotten used to dedicating their budgets towards digital channels. And what they're looking to do, obviously, is follow viewers. There is also an argument to suggest that there's some big media companies in the US that have launched to own traditional TV channels, but have also launched their own streaming services in the coming months and in the latter half of 2020. And whilst advertising revenue that's associated with any ad-supported streaming services that are on offer isn't enough to necessarily make up for the reduction in typical traditional TV revenue, it's going to indicate where the investment from those media companies goes. You know, so a number of those media companies have indicated that they will be investing in content that will be available on their streamed services ahead of being available in traditional TV channels. So all in all, it's painting a picture that the advertising spend has made a natural sort of shift towards digital channels and that viewership just continues to move from those traditional channels towards digital and streamed content. Now, I guess I'm interested in your opinions on this in general for the US market, but also whether you think there's going to be some similarities here in the UK. And also too, because particularly the three of us often return to this conversation, which is when will we see the day that everybody stops viewing broadcast scheduled TV and it becomes much more of a digital consumption? Because we know that whilst the trends indicate that's where viewership is going and therefore that's where advertising dollars will go, there's still quite a lot of popularity in some traditional broadcast TV programs. So, Lindsay, I'm going to start with you because I know you've always got strong views about, not strictly, Love Island. Is it Love Island?
Thanks. Yes. Well, do I?
What are one of those shows that you tell us everybody tunes in to watch?
Yeah. So this article is specifically about US TV viewing. And I do find it fascinating because it's interesting, given that, as was rightly raised in the article, most of the linear TV channels are now owned by big entertainment companies that have been, as you've been talking about, Rachel, have launched their own streaming platforms to great success, just to add to the bundles that exist already in the myriad offerings available in US TV viewing, in US content viewing, VOD content viewing. Mm-hmm. But I think that while it's right, it makes a lot of sense that that's where advertiser budgets are going. Advertiser budgets are going digital because that's where the audiences are, especially younger audiences, which for many of the big mainstream advertisers are probably kind of more lucrative for them and probably, you know, they get more of a return from the younger audiences than they do the older audiences. We can't ignore the importance and the continued need to invest in linear TV, as it's not going anywhere. Yes, digital is growing massively in cord cutting, especially in the US, because the US has such a different. I'm gonna have an episode.
It's very difficult to carry on with this whilst we've got Kieran dialing in via about half a dozen different devices, squinting at the screen because he's forgotten to bring his sunglasses and he can't work out what the hell is going on. I mean, can you even hear us, Kieran? Yes, you can hear us.
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry. Go ahead.
You're moving the screen around. I was going to have no
fit. It's making me motion sick, actually.
Oh, my God.
Well, the reality
is, Are you on a boat? Is that what the issue is? You're actually on a boat now.
Yes, I'm on a boat.
So like I said, we can't ignore and avoid the linear audiences because they do exist. And I think if you look at the UK and Europe, where TV consumption and just the way that TV is broadcast generally is very, very different. So we obviously have much more public service television than the US does. Most of them, the main channels that you can get in the US, you do have to access via cable. And if you can't access them via cable, you have to invest in an HD antenna. Whereas in the UK, to access those free-to-view channels, you can access them via a smart TV, access them via an antenna, via a Freeview box. There are many, many different ways to do it before having to go to, in the US, if I wanted to view CBS, for example, if I didn't have an HD antenna or a cable package, I'd have to go to their own app, which I'd have to pay for, or go to their YouTube TV channel. It's all much more complicated than it is in the UK. But if you look at, for example, what one of our biggest public service broadcasters, Channel 4, are doing at the moment, they've realised during the pandemic that many more of their audiences are going digital and going to their VOD platform, All 4. And in particular, some of their younger skewed shows actually for the first time outweighed the number of viewers viewing on All 4 outweighed those viewing on Channel 4 on linear TV. So it shows that there is as a public service broadcaster, your remit is to reach the largest audience you possibly can. So you have to go where the audience is. And that's what the interesting thing is. These the advertisers are going where their audiences are. And that's what we have to remember. If the audiences are going digital, and that there's no point in them investing in linear if the audiences aren't there and they're not getting any return on it. So I find the whole thing interesting. I don't think linear can be forgotten about, but I think that if you are a broadcaster, you have to have to plan for both, basically. And that's what Channel 4 were doing. Another example of the UK of this is BBC Three, which was a BBC channel that was made to go digital four or five years ago. I think it was 2016. It went fully digital. They're now thinking of bringing it back to a linear broadcast channel because its viewing has dropped 72% in the meantime, despite having big shows that launched on there like Fleabag, like Killing Eve. So I think that just proves in the UK market, at least, that you do need a hybrid approach, and advertisers need to think about that as well. Advertisers can't just shift all their budget digitally unless it's where their 100% their audience is. But again, it's for many advertisers, it's what is also the easier option. If the deals aren't there in linear TV trading anymore and it's easier for them to buy digital, plus it's where their audience is, it makes sense for them to go that direction.
So it would just be really interesting to see what happens to traditional TV advertising spend in the UK this year and whether it does follow the same logic or not. And like you say, the logic is different here to what it is in the US. I mean, and you raise a really good point, in conclusion there, Lindsay, which is that marketers are tasked with finding the biggest and most relevant audience. So that's where they're going to put the money. Kieran, you're often a dissenter of linear traditional TV.
I don't believe this. I don't believe the numbers in the UK, and I'm because there's no real research. This comes from like a body that's owned by TV companies, right? So there's no independent sort of numbers here. I'm just telling you from my own point of view, right? I have not seen a TV ad in months, right? Because I'm watching SVOD, I'm watching streaming, and the question I have here is, during this pandemic, I'd say most people have been spending their time on streaming services, right? And okay, so Channel 4 is probably a BVOD where it's ad supported, right? Predominantly, most people are spending their time on Prime and Netflix. That's a fact, right? So I'm trying to figure out what is the future of TV advertising, right? If there is no inventory available, right? Because
I think another thing that's associated with this, though, is content. So the story that you just told, Lindsay, about BBC Three is interesting because I think that, where linear is still experiencing a lot of popularity in the UK is with particular types of content that cannot be accessed anywhere else.
Yeah, and my view is I'd be very interested to see where TV advertising goes, right? Because within a 10-year period, I think ad-funded linear TV is going to die, right? Mm. It's going to die because the habits of anybody under the age of, 40 are completely different from people over 40. I know Lindsay disagrees with this because, there's obviously some hits with ITV and stuff, but I think just because of the sheer scale of the streaming services, right, And you know, there'll be more stuff like BritBox coming out, and the British content producers are going to go where the money is. I would really question if there is a future for TV advertising. I really would.
Are you referring to BVOD as well, or purely linear?
I'm thinking about both, because people have talked about AVOD being this big savior of, you know, the money is going to switch from analog to digital to AVOD, like, you know, via AVOD. Like, I still haven't seen it. I don't know. Like, we sit around the office. Well, when we were in the office, trying to figure out where is this great CTV revolution coming from? Like, where are these apps that are ad funded that are supporting content? And the reality is, where are they? I don't know who they are at scale. And Netflix is still not going down the ad route, and maybe they never will. They don't have to, by the looks of it. They've gone down and said, we'll never have ads on our inventory, and neither are Prime. Oh,
they just up their prices, right, in the UK, so they've upped their prices.
Exactly, and people are happy to pay that.
Like sponsored product placement.
Yes.
They go big on product placement.
And that's big. That's probably going to be a big earner for them. So this is more of a, I suppose, an existential question. Is there going to be a TV ad advertising, you know, industry in 10 years or even in the medium term? Because I'm thinking about the trends here, right? I would love to see research around this consumption habits of the British population or even the European population after the pandemic is sort of quieting down. And I don't think there's been enough written about this. Like, I keep thinking, where is the TV advertising inventory going to come from? If you and I and half the population are consuming content on streaming services with no ads, how does a TV advertising marketer get to me or get to you? That's my question.
Yeah, but I think some of this will then have to do with the ways in which content providers fund the production of that content, right? Because, you know, typically that's what advertising paid for, in part at least. And so at the moment, you know, I think we're at an interesting sort of junction, really, because one of the reasons that Netflix, I suppose, did so well in 2020 was not just because it's a high-quality streaming service and people were prepared to either continue or, you know, add on a subscription to Netflix as part of their monthly outgoings last year when they weren't really doing anything else, but it's also that they had recorded and already produced a whole lot of content that gave them no problems with their content schedule for 2020. Now that we're coming into 2021, they've created some additional content in the meantime, and they're talking about what will happen to their content schedule for 2021. And they're also relying on lots of access to back catalogue content. But they would need deep pockets to continue producing that really high quality Hollywood style content and to pay those actors and producers and everything else and to, you know, book that studio time. And can they continue to do that? I mean, maybe they can.
The question we need to ask ourselves here, has the streaming services broke the back of ad-funded content, right? And a TV ad-funded content? That's the question I want to ask people.
From a viewer's point of view, I reckon that is absolutely the case, because like you, Kieran, I don't watch any ad-funded content anymore. And so on the very rare occasion that I do, I just find it totally bizarre. I forget that ad breaks exist when they come along.
Exactly. I mean, let's be honest here. The biggest CTV platform in the world is YouTube, right? And that's where digital buyers go to. I'd love to see more pieces from a marketer's point of view going, because in that article from The Information, it's saying that a lot of the mid-sized platforms like Pinterest and Snapchat have done really, really well during the pandemic because money has shifted across. Look, I would say the younger people, right, are not consuming content the way we used to, right? Whereas you say yourself, right, you watch a TV program and there's an ad. I haven't seen an ad in 6 months.
I've said this to you before. I would say that also you two are probably not atypical for London, but you are atypical for the other 55 million people in the UK. that do still watch TV via Freeview or via Sky, which is largely still ad funded, as they're watching addressable TV. That's very ad funded as well. So that you've still got that massive portion of the population that's still very, very buoyant. And while broadcast VOD and AVOD, while broadcast VOD is growing and while streaming subscriptions are massively growing, Disney Plus launched this year, every market it operated in, and obviously Netflix and Amazon Prime, there is still that market that isn't. I'm a Sky subscriber. I'm a Sky customer, so I see TV ads all the time.
Yeah, but but people can access Sky via Now TV, and there's no ads on that. There's no ads on that Now TV at all.
It's a different experience. If you're not ready to cut the cord, Sky and Now TV are two extremely different experiences.
My point is, that's fine now, but I don't see how that continues, because the kids coming up are not consuming. They're consuming it via platforms. They're consuming it via Roku.
If they are consuming it via YouTube, actually, I would argue that's an environment where we're becoming more ads tolerant, because I would also argue that the quality of ads on YouTube are a lot better than the quality of the ads on some streaming services. So,
because they're shorter.
Yep, they're shorter, and also they're just better quality.
They're more variegated as well.
Yeah. So I would argue that actually that is a platform where, because if we look at literally kids and young teenagers and where they're consuming content, they are absolutely used to consuming content on a bigger TV size screen without any advertising, except I suppose if it's YouTube. But definitely when they're consuming content on something that's smaller, handheld or laptops or whatever, and it is via YouTube, they're consuming ads. And they'd be used to that by now. Completely.
I would make a prediction now. If I was a big marketer, I wouldn't spend as much money on TV ads. I'd be spending money on digital, on platform based buys, on programmatic, new merging channels, gaming, where people are actually doing stuff, where people are engaging with it. I think this is gonna be an interesting conversation, because the agencies, the big holding groups, make a lot of money off TV advertising. It's a big margin business for them. And I wonder if they're kind of holding on to that, even though the trends are against, you know, the growth of that medium.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think much of it is definitely legacy. And then also, and when you refer to linear TV advertising, you're of course referring, I'm presuming, to brand TV rather than DRTV.
Exactly.
Brand TV is obviously the big money slots during X Factor and whatever else, and during Love Island. They're the ones that still hold. That's where the big budgets are going. It's where the big kickbacks are going. It's where the big trading deals are going. The DRTV slots, which arguably actually still perform probably very, very well for those watching TV during the daytime, they're probably the ones that's probably where there is still a stronger market. DRTV will probably last longer than brand TV will, and brand TV will end up probably being consumed subsumed within more bundles than it ever has been before. I think you're right in the long term, Kira. I think you're right, but I think in the here and now, there's still a long way for. There's still a lot of linear that's being unaccounted for, I would say.
Lindsay, where do you think that brand TV advertising will go? Just disappear altogether?
I think that it will become, rather than being the flagship and the kind of the big ticket item in any upfront or any kind of campaign, any trading deal that happens within TV, I think that will largely be tied up in a digital bundle, digital advertising bundle instead.
I see what you mean.
As a wider package. Because it's already being seen, those big shows aren't getting the audiences they used to anyway. So the attractiveness of those is not there anyway in the first place.
So I think that's what will happen, is that what constitutes, it's a bit like the streaming world for music sort of 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. What constitutes a big audience now for any kind of linear TV experience is so much smaller than it used to be. And I think that will just continue to dwindle as people just continue to consume content in lots of different ways, and that becomes more disparate. And at the moment, I think it's a bit too difficult to predict exactly what will happen with TV advertising in the UK for all of the reasons aforementioned. But Kieran, your prediction of 10 years out is probably, you know, quite right.
I think it could be sooner because I'll just finish this, but the platforms and the streaming services like the Apple will spend more money on content, right? So that's another way. It's about attention, right? So think about this. Disney Plus Disney has gone all in on Disney Plus, right? They said, you know what? This is the future of our business. It's been an absolute, you know, a pull and a drag internally in this because they have legacy, you know, cable business, cable TV business. They've got, you know, their addiction to cinema revenues, but they've gone all in on Disney Plus. And that is going to be a draw on attention, right? And it's like, you know, here's Disney Plus, here's Netflix, here's Prime, right? And a lot of these businesses are like, apart from Disney and Netflix, who are, you know, focused on content, like Prime and Apple TV are just effectively helping to fuel other parts of business.
Those businesses.
Like, yeah. Mm. And this is the problem on Channel 4 and ITV face. These are huge issues, like, you know, especially if linear TV has been TV advertising revenue has been whittled down. Like, so it's going to be interesting. Put it that way.
Final story of the podcast, quick before Kieran's boat moors on a neighbouring island and he's got to get off and, you know, shake out his towel and apply the sunscreen, is shooting over to the APAC marketplace, TikTok having been banned in India for at least 6 months now, has given rise to a number of locally born and bred short form video sharing platforms. And it's really interesting to see the growth in popularity of these platforms and whether that's actually going to have any longevity outside the Indian market, which is an enormous marketplace within itself, and whether that's also going to give rise to the same sorts of trends either in other APAC markets or in other global markets. So competitive platforms include the likes of MX TakaTak, Josh, Mudge, and Raposo, which are all really well pronounced.
Butchering those terms there, Rich.
Really well pronounced. And have also attracted a lot of interest from investors. So arguably these kind of short form video sharing platforms are also becoming, you know, a proliferation of social platforms and are disrupting certainly the hold over the marketplace that TikTok would have had. It's not available in India. I'm just interested to know whether you guys think this is something that will continue to be a trend, what that might look like in a marketplace that's the size of India. Will it actually disrupt some of the more traditional social media platforms altogether? Is it going to be something that other marketplaces or other countries maybe look to, and never mind the banning of a major platform, start to think that there's some value in putting together a challenger to some of the already existing short-form video sharing platforms, the likes of Instagram and TikTok? Lindsay?
I think this is interesting. I think there's, first of all, there are tons of them. Like, there's way too many. So interesting to see who wins out. And interesting to see who's investing in them as well. Like, Google appear to be hedging their bets by investing in a few of them and probably seeing which one will win out. Twitter have been investing, Microsoft as well. And what fascinates me about them, though, is how they are going to, first of all, what the content's like and how they're going to encourage and attract content creators to come to the front and choose their platform, because they probably aren't going to do it across every single one that exists. And then how they will monetize, kind of how they will get advertisers on board. A couple of them, there's one called, I think, Chingari, which sounds a bit like it's going in sort of the Quibi direction. So it's partnering with some already existing kind of content creators. And I think that's, given how well Quibi went, I would say stop now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there, I do find it interesting. I don't necessarily think that any of them will branch out of India, though. I don't know if there's any need to, because you've got an audience of the market size of India in the billions. Do you need to? Would you go further out? And it's proven with a lot of Indian content entertainment companies, they don't tend to go outside of India. They'll go outside of India to reach their expat market, but not to actually expand and broaden to other nations. So I don't necessarily think they will bother with, but India is such an exciting market and a fascinating market with such huge growth opportunity. And the need for short form video content in India, I think, is replicated probably in every market. So if TikTok were to disappear tomorrow from the UK, you'd probably see a lot of other kind of
competitors.
Up and coming platforms coming up out of nowhere that again would get sort of similar investment opportunities, probably less so because you might get more US ones. But I do think what's interesting for me is how the advertiser will come on board. Because the beauty of TikTok was that it was one big global, it was a big global brand. If I were a global advertiser, I could easily target India as well as I could the UK, as well as I could France and the US. When you've got more local, more regionalized platforms, it changes the face of how advertising looks and what advertisers are interested in targeting those different their audiences, and how disparate and how spread out are the audiences, how many of them are using multiples of these or just going to one. So I think there's going to be a lot of winnowing down of what the audience looks like, where it's going, who it's using, to see who will ultimately kind of reign supreme in this crazy market.
Karen, what do you think? Short form, snackable content, this might be yet another thing that starts to disrupt more traditional viewing habits.
Yeah, I think it's started already. I mean, obviously, TikTok's success has shown that this is the future of social media. And this is kind of why Facebook could be in trouble fairly soon, because it's just evolving so quickly, people's consumption habits. Lindsay's right. It's a sort of like a money game. Whoever wins out here is going to be the dominant player in that market. And India is a unique market. Like, you know, and there's a big, big play in the country around sort of national champions. Like, you know what I mean? They really want sort of Indian companies to dominate the consumer internet market on the B2B internet market, because they're wary of, you know, it's a country probably wary of colonialism, and they've already banned quite a lot of Chinese apps. And I think the Americans are trying to get involved in the country by proxy, by investing in local players, so they can get access to the growth of the market. So it's an interesting market. But you know, the thing about India is that its infrastructure still isn't up to scratch with most modern sort of economies. So the short form thing might actually work for them because of bandwidth and all the rest of it. So you can imagine that there could be quite a lot of innovation there in around that sort of new format. So
and I suppose quite interesting. And I suppose that's why I'm interested to know whether that might also appeal to maybe some other Southeast Asian countries who perhaps arguably have slightly more sophisticated, I mean, there's many Southeast Asian countries that have significantly more sophisticated infrastructure, but there might still be some that are lagging behind in infrastructure sophistication that see that as an opportunity, and there might be some challenges in those marketplaces that pop up, or just some local versions that are much better at tailoring content and adapting to local audiences.
Yeah, I think that the more it's good to not see Facebook and Google controlling this entire market. It's good to see different sort of players in the market. Like, and TikTok was obviously an interesting arrival on the scene in the US until the Donald got really angry because they kind of messed up his rally and decided to ban them. It wasn't to do with the Chinese; it was to do with the fact that poor Al Donald's Oklahoma rally wasn't attended very well because all the TikTokers decided to play a prank on him. Such a petulant piece of shit he is.
Yes.
And now hopefully he'll be in jail soon, by the looks of it. So it is interesting. I think that India thing is quite unique because, you know, you tend to get a lot of the other players just scaling in Europe and the US, but India is quite a unique market. And Modi is pushing this national champion thing fairly hard. Like, so yeah.
Before you know it, maybe there'll be an Indian company included in Mr. Ad.
maybe.
All right, we've got the fingerprint of doom coming from Kieran, which is him trying to rearrange his phone there in Tenerife. So I think we can safely say that's us for the Mad Tech podcast this week. Thank you very much for joining us, listeners, and thank you very much, Kieran.
Yes, apologies about the production this week. I'm trying to do better. It was last minute, so next week we'll have a better thing. It's actually starting to fucking rain here, believe it or not.
Oh, I feel so sorry for you. Thanks very much, Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you. Good luck, Rachel.
And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.